Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
There's no more time to hang back or sit in the fence or argue amongst ourselves. This is the challenge of our collective lifetimes, the existential threat to human existence as we know it. And every day we delay, the cost of inaction increases. So let this be the moment that we answer history's call here in Glasgow.
Back on November 1st, President Joe Biden issued this call to action at the COP26 Global Climate Summit. Now, 2 weeks later, the summit is at an end, and world leaders from close to 200 countries have agreed to a pact meant to address the effects of climate change. But the agreement suffers from many of the inequities that characterize the challenges of global climate change. Rich nations continue to contribute much more of the planet-warming fossil fuel emissions, and poor countries suffer many more of the life-altering consequences of those changes. The COP26 agreement does little to ensure that wealthier countries provide the foundational resources necessary for poorer nations to cope with the changes that they are already experiencing. Now, experts maintain that we must slow global warming so that it does not exceed 1.5 degrees Celsius above the temperatures recorded in the kind of pre-industrial age. But the COP26 agreement sets a goal of keeping warming at 2 degrees Celsius or below. It's progress, but it's probably not aggressive enough to stave off the most devastating effects of the heating planet. This means we can likely expect more frequent and brutal storms in the coming years. Now, the nations have agreed to reduce fossil fuel use. And this is the first time in a global climate pact that fossil fuels have even received mention. But the decision to use the language phase down rather than phasing out, well, that has drawn criticism from activists. So after 2 weeks of conversation and contestation, what will the agreement of COP26 accomplish? This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and we're asking, so what? We're joined now by Dr. Michael E. Mann, Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Pennsylvania State University and author of The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Dr. Mann, great to have you here.
Thank you, Melissa. It's great to be with you.
All right, so let's just start with that so what question. Do summits like COP26 matter?
Well, they do. I mean, the United States Framework Convention on Climate Change is the only multilateral process that we have for addressing the climate crisis, for creating global policy to address the climate crisis. So we can't throw it out. Move away from it. We need to embrace that process while making sure that it's working properly, that it's functioning properly. And as you very well summarized in the opening here, we did make some real progress, but we didn't make enough progress. And so if you look at where we were, say, going into the Paris summit back in 2016, COP21, we were looking at 4 degrees Celsius, better part at 9 degrees Fahrenheit warming of the planet, seven degrees Fahrenheit warming of the planet. We were looking at 4 degrees Celsius warming. Now, as you already mentioned, we're now probably looking at less than 2 degrees Celsius warming of the planet, less than 4 degrees Fahrenheit warming of the planet, if all the countries make good on their obligations. And that's an important caveat. So that's real progress. And as you said, for the first time, the gorilla in the room is being mentioned here, fossil fuels. And there was language. We would have liked to hear that language say phasing out coal, because that's what we need to do. Instead, ironically, it wasn't one of the G7 countries that weighed in at the very end to water down the language. It was India. And that takes us to this point that you made, that part of the friction here is sort of the differential responsibilities and interests of the developing world and the industrial world. And that's a problem that we need to solve.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you brought us to that point about India sort of weighing in here. So, you know, when we think again about that kind of pre-industrial age, we're talking about a time when, you know, Western Europe, the United States, were able to build, to grow economies, to grow, you know, the health of our populations, and to do so while massively polluting. And now, right, as we look at nations that are emerging into that same space, they're in part asking for those sort of same capacities to address the human health and wealth of their nations and economies while not being constrained to polluting standards that are so much stricter than what the U.S. and Western Europe experienced.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I'm coming to you from the state of Pennsylvania, where I live. And this is the state where we discovered oil in this country. It was built on coal. It's a truly a fossil fuel state. And we had access, you know, two centuries of access to cheap, dirty energy to grow our economies. We know that we're now seeing the detrimental impacts of that worldwide. And we can't afford for the rest of the world to make the same mistake that we made, to build their economies based on dirty fossil fuel energy. We have to help them leapfrog past that stage. And that's why, as you alluded to earlier, it's so critical that the United States and other industrial countries ante up and provide the funds necessary to make it economically advantageous for the developing countries to skip the fossil fuel stage and develop clean energy infrastructure. It'll be better for them. It'll be better for the planet. But we've got to make it worth their while economically. And thus far, we haven't come up with the promised funds of $100 billion a year, which is the estimate of what it would take to make that happen. And so while, you know, India was technically the one that sort of threw that monkey wrench into the works late in the conference, let's realize that they're probably frustrated, and other developing countries are probably frustrated that, hey, they're dealing with the brunt of the problem. They're seeing the worst impacts of climate change. They had the least role in creating this problem in the first place, and we haven't yet done enough to help them along.
Talk to me a bit about the promises versus implementation gap. You've pointed out that this is the one sort of multilateral space to make these agreements. Is there any multilateral capacity to hold nations to these agreements?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, unfortunately, the UNFCC doesn't really provide for any official mechanisms, punitive mechanisms, legal enforcement mechanisms. There's a debate about how you would legally enforce the provisions of these treaties. And so thus far, it's really been much more of a sort of name and shame approach, which is to say that you become a pariah if you're not living up to your responsibilities. And here's the thing, individual countries do retain the right to levy tariffs and to impose fees on those countries, border adjustments, we sometimes call them, on those countries that aren't doing, you know, their part. And so there are enforcement mechanisms politically and economically that can be used by individual countries, but there isn't really a multilateral framework for that.
Talk about China. What is the likelihood of China following through on its commitments? And does any of this matter if they don't?
Yeah, you know, it matters so much what sort of signal we send to the world. And before, you know, more than four, I guess, you know, it's back in 2016 when Barack Obama was president, we were displaying global leadership on climate. Our Secretary of State, John Kerry, successfully negotiated a bilateral agreement back in 2015 with China. It was for us to bring our carbon emissions down within a decade and a half, and for them to bring their emissions to a peak within roughly that same time frame, bring them to a peak before bringing them down. And that laid the groundwork for a very successful Paris Agreement. And here's the thing, China not only lived up to their end of the bargain, they exceeded it. They began to decommission coal-fired power plants. And what that tells me is that when the United States is serious, when they demonstrate to the world, and the Obama administration did, that we're serious about owning up to our responsibilities. Other critical actors like China do engage in good faith and they meet their obligations. And they are currently the largest carbon polluter in the world. But let's not forget, we are the largest legacy carbon polluter in the world. We've added more carbon pollution to the atmosphere than any other country. And so it's so critical that these two countries be working together. And that's probably more than anything else what makes me cautiously or at least stubbornly optimistic about the result of Glasgow, that you now have an agreement between China and the U.S. to work together. And next week, Joe Biden and Chinese president are going to be meeting virtually again to discuss progress here.
Now, COP26 was billed as, quote, the last best hope to save the planet. I'm wondering, do I need to start saving my dollars to go to that space hotel that Jeff Bezos is is building? Or do you think we did enough in this that maybe we can, in fact, save the planet?
Yeah, as my Princeton colleague, who you may know, Michael Oppenheimer, weighed in the other day in an AP article, 1.5 degrees Celsius, that's on life support. I think that's a fair description. It's not dead. We kept it alive, just barely. That was, the remit of this meeting was to keep 1.5C alive. And we did it by the closest of margins, which means that, we have a lot more work to be done. The good thing here is we're not going to wait 5 years, as we've been doing in the past, to revisit these commitments. The meeting final statement coerces the countries of the world to come back next year and ratchet up those commitments so that we can get onto that path that limits warming below that dangerous 1.5 Celsius, 3 degree Fahrenheit.
Now, I know the big question of global climate change is, in fact, at the national and international level. But with this last minute, are there things that individuals can be doing that make a difference?
Absolutely. Vote, of course, but use your voice, hold policymakers accountable, make noise, do everything we can to make sure that they act on our behalf rather than on behalf of the polluters.
Dr. Michael E. Mann is Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Pennsylvania State University and author of The New Climate War. Dr. Mann, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
A new investigation by the Washington Post has revealed that the Israeli army is photographing tens of thousands of Palestinian civilians, adults, and children, and then using these images to build a massive facial recognition database. According to the report, the facial recognition technology is then deployed against these same civilians to limit movement and constrain the lives of the Palestinian population. Former soldiers told the Washington Post that units were incentivized to compete with one another to collect the most civilian photographs. Now, to better understand what's at stake in this practice, I spoke with Elizabeth Dwoskin, the Washington Post Silicon Valley correspondent.
When I first started asking questions about, tell me what's the extent of digital surveillance in Israel's occupied territories, it was like nobody in Israel could give me an answer. And that is because the Israeli army has huge claims around state secrets for their technology. But what I learned through a bunch of luck and a bunch of reporting is that there's been this vastly expanded digital surveillance in the last 2 years. And that includes this network of smartphones. It's a program that is called Blue Wolf. One soldier described it to me as a secret Facebook for Palestinians that the Israeli army keeps. The way it was described to me is that when the Israeli army was building this database, they would give smartphones to unit commanders and people on a patrol in the city of Hebron and other parts of the West Bank. And they would be told to take as many photographs of Palestinians as possible. And that includes children and the elderly. And they would upload the photographs. And if the photographs had a match, with an existing photo in the Blue Wolf app, then a profile would come up. And the profile would flash red, yellow, or green to say if the person should be arrested immediately, detained, or allowed to pass. The other component that I learned about is when I went to Hebron, people would tell me, in addition to having our photos taken all the time, this city is kind of strung up with checkpoints everywhere. It's within a city. So it's not like a checkpoint to enter Israel. It's just checkpoints that control people's movements. And when they walk to the checkpoints, which are part of daily life there, they would tell me that in the last 6-7 months, when they walk to the checkpoint, the soldiers manning the checkpoint recognize them before they give their ID, which is what you need to pass through. And later I spoke with a soldier who said that in fact, there has been this broader expansion of facial recognition there. And it can also recognize vehicles. It can tie a vehicle to a person. And then the third component is kind of like, you have to, I think, imagine this very dystopian reality that people live in the West Bank, which is in certain parts where I was, there's cameras just everywhere put up by the army.
My iPhone has pictures of my friends, my family, and it will guess who a new picture is. So I have a nephew, and my nephew McKinley, my iPhone typically thinks McKinley is everything from a 6-month-old infant to my elderly, grandparent. I mean, like seriously, at any point it will say, oh, is this McKinley, right? It'll think that McKinley is a baby, or it'll think McKinley is a white woman, like just all the things that McKinley might be. And it's clearly doing a very bad job at recognizing McKinley's face. But I'm wondering if sort of even, so we'll get to the question of even if the facial recognition is right, but I want to first start with, from a algorithmic standpoint, how much should we even trust that this facial recognition is seeing, right, sort of in an AI kind of way, that it's seeing who it thinks it's seeing?
That is exactly the problem. What you're talking about is Apple's custom facial recognition. But one thing we know is that there's wide degrees of accuracy around facial recognition technologies, despite the fact that there is a huge march. In the last few years, even in the United States, there's been a major expansion of the use of facial recognition technology by law enforcement agencies, TSA, the FBI. It was used during the January 6th insurrection investigations as well, these face matching software. So they're all over the place. Lots of companies build these kinds of tools, and there's varying degrees of accuracy. One thing we know is researchers have done studies which say that the accuracy for faces with darker skin, so if your nephew is Black, it's going to have a lower accuracy. So we know that there's lower accuracy with darker skinned faces. We know there's some lower accuracy with women. And then you could think about in the Palestinian territories, these are women. A lot of them are also wearing head coverings if they're religious. So maybe there's fabric that conceals some of the face. And so, yeah, I mean, there's huge questions of whether that matching is correct.
Is there any sense of a legal or ethical requirement to gain consent before taking someone's photograph?
I mean, I think that there's a huge sense of that in a democracy, and the West Bank and the Palestinian Israel is democracy, but its occupied territories are not run like a democracy. It's a military controlled area. And you see this also in parts of China as well. This is why many, many activists and experts have said to me that places where people have limited freedom, that is the testing ground for surveillance technologies. Just as a case in point, in Israel, right 45 minutes away from the West Bank, or in some cases 5 minutes because of the way the borders are drawn, there is a huge debate right now going on about the ability for police to use facial recognition cameras in public places. That's not just taking a photo on the street. That's using facial recognition that the Israeli government's privacy authority has advised against doing, the very thing that they're doing to the Palestinian population. And to your question about taking photos of people, I mean, yeah, how would you feel if somebody stopped you on the street and said, I'm going to need to take your picture? You would say, back off. Like, why are you taking my picture? Like, you would have all these questions and rights and you wouldn't allow it. And people in an occupied territory, people under military rule, they don't have those rights. They don't have the legal recourse. And I should add, the soldiers themselves who were tasked to do this, at least the ones that I interviewed, were super traumatized by it. They really saw how even taking people's pictures, what a privacy violation people felt that was. And they were being asked to take pictures of elderly people and elderly women who may be religious. They may not want to take off the headscarf. Children, and what risk could little children pose? What is the rationale? A lot of them were wondering that themselves. And again, this was devised as a form of competition for soldiers as well. So whichever unit took the most pictures in a week would get a prize, like a night off. It was actually gamified by the army.
All right, so you get what's at stake here. Now, that was Elizabeth Dwoskin, the Washington Post Silicon Valley correspondent. Now, here to talk to us on the implications of this targeted surveillance against Palestinians and what it could mean in other parts of the world is non-resident senior fellow at the Arab Center in D.C., Youssef Munayyer. I started off by asking Youssef about how the surveillance program differs from surveillance that we've seen in the past.
This is just the sort of latest technological step to enable what has been a longstanding practice of deep, deep surveillance of Palestinian society by the Israeli state and the Israeli military. And, you know, as time marches on and technology advances, we're learning about new methods that are being used. And this is, you know, just sort of the most recent one. But of course, everything from cyber surveillance to phone tapping to spy networks have been, you know, used historically by the Israeli military and the Israeli state against the Palestinian people in occupied territory and beyond. So I think, you know, what of course makes this different, a little bit different, is, you know, what makes all of these technological advances in surveillance technology so much more dangerous, and that's the speed and the scale and the scope at which the state can collect information, readily access that information, and then weaponize or operationalize it. And when you have, you know, at the touch of, a button, facial images being matched of, you know, potentially millions of people, there's a tremendous amount of power in that, and a tremendous opportunity for misuse and abuse, as is the case with any form of vast surveillance network. This is just, as I said, the latest step in what's been a longstanding practice that's, you know, really, really born out of a situation of fundamental inequality. I think, your previous guest, you know, made an important point in noting that there is, in occupied Palestinian territory, no citizenship rights for Palestinians, no civil liberties for Palestinians, no reasonable expectation to privacy, and so on. There is military rule. And of course, the state has tremendous power over the population and is not really limited by any sort of framework of civil rights and liberties, because it doesn't exist there. So what ends up happening in spaces like the occupied Palestinian territory is that these sorts of technologies are used to extents and in ways that are probably not possible anywhere else in the world, where there would be, you know, certainly not in the advanced world, where you would have much greater sort of limitations on the power and the reach of government surveillance. So, you know, Palestinians end up becoming something of a laboratory for technology, which is being developed, but importantly also then exported around the world. And I think this is one of the important dimensions of this.
Can you talk to me a bit about what it means to live under that level of surveillance at all times?
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely terrifying. It is, there is a constant sense that you are under watch, under control, and that there is, you know, a panopticon all around you. The situation in different parts of Palestinian territory varies, right, when it comes to this sort of physical surveillance and the shape of cameras. But when we talk about like movement and access throughout the West Bank, there are restrictions, checkpoints in many different places, And then you have, of course, a massive network of settlements and military bases throughout the territory, all of which come with their own attached surveillance infrastructure. Security agents, military soldiers, and so on, operating the movement and access throughout this entire space. So you are constantly under the eye of the military, constantly. And especially when you try to move from one place to the other, in some places like Hebron, for example, where Elizabeth was, it's even moving, across the street is something that cannot happen without deep, deep military surveillance of your activities.
In what ways are these experiences of Palestinians, both as a matter of the technology and the lived experience you just talked with us about, why is that a kind of miner's canary for those of us in other parts of the world?
Yeah, as I said, so Palestinians are this really unique, unfortunately, this really unique testing ground, because there are so little limitations on state power that you can get away with a kind of surveillance that you probably won't in a lot of other places. And this has allowed the Israeli military to really hone and refine various different surveillance technologies that can then be marketed through its own military intelligence industry to other countries around the world. And we know for a fact that, the NSO group, which is one of these Israeli corporations that is having its products authorized for sale by the Israeli Defense Ministry to other governments, is selling surveillance technology to other regimes around the world, which has been implicated in the surveillance and targeting of human rights activists, of journalists, for example, like Jamal Khashoggi and the people around him, and many others. So, I think it's important for us to keep in mind that these techniques, these methods of surveillance, of repression, which are being tested and perfected on Palestinians, are not staying in Palestine. As important it is to understand what is happening in Palestine, it's also important to understand that they are coming to a state near you in the near future. And because of how integrated the state of Israel is into the sort of global, national security regime and within the sort of broader family of Western allies, it's very possible that the types of technology, surveillance technology, repressive methods that are perfected on Palestinians might be sold to our government, might be sold to other allied governments in Europe, and in fact have been, right? And used on people outside of Israel and Palestine as well.
Youssef Munayyer is Senior Fellow at the Arab Center in D.C. Youssef, thank you so much for joining The Takeaway.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
On this week's On the Media, what happened to the offbeat, irreverent, speaking truth to power alt-weeklies that used to populate newsstands across the country?
The Voice was their guide to life, from people who cared about what they were covering with such intensity that there were fistfights and brawls inside the paper. That's gone.
The end of an era on this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks for having me.
When I walked back out of the clinic, it felt like I was walking into Oz. Like I walked down into camp from Kansas into that clinic and then came back out, and it was like, everything was electrified. I mean, the sounds were brighter, a lot louder, the sky was bluer, the greens were greener, everything was, the birds were chirping really loud. And much later on, I realized that was, you know, shock.
This is Tez Anderson. He's one of the more than a million Americans currently living with HIV. He was first diagnosed positive in 1986, and that was a time when, on average, an AIDS patient died within 15 months of diagnosis. Tez was only 26 years old when he received the news that made the world feel like Oz, buzzing with shock. Nearly 35 years later, Tez Anderson is still living, loving, and working. And today, the landscape of HIV is quite different. With the right medications, long-term treatments, and moderate lifestyle adjustments like nutrition and sleep regularity, people with HIV can expect to live just as long as their counterparts who are negative. New antiretroviral therapies, or ART, can make HIV viral load undetectable, meaning that someone who's HIV positive cannot pass the infection to others. And together with the effective use of PrEP medications for HIV-negative individuals, HIV is no longer a death sentence or a sentence to loneliness. But for those who survive the most brutal decades of the pandemic, there are costs to surviving. The loss of so many friends and loved ones, years spent preparing for death rather than building life, and the challenges of living to an age you never thought you'd reach. For this installment of our takeaway series, Aging While Queer, we spoke with Tez and began with the shock of his initial diagnosis.
Everyone was dying. And the fact was that 10 years later, I realized that I actually seroconverted and became HIV positive in 1983, because I was dating a guy that died from something mysterious. We didn't know what it was, and we lost touch because he lived out of town. And he was having something going on with his blood. And he sent me a letter saying, I'm going through some changes lately, to the tune of about 35 pounds less. And that was the last letter I ever got from him. And I remember that summer was when I had all the symptoms of seroconversion, but it took me a long time to put that together. I was diagnosed in 86. I've been living with the virus since 1983.
And so here you are, decades later, not gone. I'm wondering if the Oz effect is still in effect, maybe particularly in the moment of the pandemic crisis. I'm wondering about whether or not there was a renewed sense of shock and terror.
You know, at the beginning of the COVID pandemic, there was a little bit of echoes from the early days of the pandemic, of the HIV pandemic. I mean, it's funny, I was in Washington, D.C. this past week, and a bus road drive by ending the pandemic. And I'm like, which one? You know, because I've lived through two now. So at first there was shocks of the early days of AIDS, because no one knew how it was transmitted and that sort of stuff. But that didn't last very long, because they're very different viruses. And also because when HIV first arrived, no one noticed, no one gave a damn. And it was buried on the back page of the New York Times. And it was a very small news. With COVID, everybody was involved. It was much more infectious, of course. So there's similarities, but there's very big differences too. But at the beginning, yeah, I was like, oh my God, here we go again. Mm.
I actually turned in those early days to some of my friends and colleagues who are HIV positive to ask them specifically about, you know, how to think about and talk about what it meant to be in a contagious public health crisis. And I mean, given that literally some of the players on the national stage, like Fauci, were the same actual players, right? What we needed to be thinking about and looking for that maybe we missed in the 80s.
I mean, the thing was that there really is no group of people who know more about surviving a pandemic than HIV long-term survivors. I mean, there's 1.1 or 1.2 million people in the U.S. now living with HIV, and over half of them are over 50, quarter of them. 25% are long-term survivors like myself, who were diagnosed at a time before there were effective medications. In fact, when I was diagnosed, there were no medications. and you know, people were dying. I think the kind of swimming upstream feeling that that people were getting during COVID, and the panic and the sheer confusion and terror that they were feeling, was something that we were familiar with and had navigated our way through, most of us. I mean, it's interesting how in the early days of the COVID pandemic, it brought up a lot of stuff from the early pandemic. But for me, when I first found out I was positive, I decided to be the best dying guy in the world. How about books on death and dying? And I plunged myself into the idea that I was going to die. And I lived that way for 20 years. I mean, I went back to the doctor after the first 2 years and he said, 2 more years. I was like, okay, well, readjust there. And we did that for a decade. And I finally said, you don't really have any idea what you're talking about, do you? And he said, well, not exactly. And I said, well, then stop telling people they're dying, because they make plans to die and not plans to live. And at some point, that very idea that dying, I can wrap my brain around, because it was logical. It was, we were put on Earth for one reason, to eventually die. What we do with that time is ours, but I'm just saying that we all gonna, it's all the same end point. And for me, I realized that I had to kind of, I don't know, step up to the plate and live as well as I could live. I was ill prepared for aging with HIV. As I started approaching 50, I went down a bad rabbit hole. It was about 5 years of a dark night of the soul. That's a pleasant way of putting a nervous breakdown. Because I was having all these things going on. I was, you know, scared and depressed and couldn't sleep and was having nightmares and was suicidal and was isolated and had very negative thoughts. And apparently I was very, 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 very angry and unpleasant. I didn't really know how much I was, but the idea that living with HIV was as big a upheaval as learning that I was going to die was kind of what was the origins for AIDS survivor syndrome.
When you say that you were ill-prepared to age with HIV, walk me through that a little bit more. Certainly part of it is about losing others, being a survivor, but what was making you angry?
I felt I blamed myself. I felt stupid for not having, I mean, for instance, dead guys don't need 401ks, whatever they are. So I spent my life not planning. I didn't save for retirement because I wasn't supposed to retire. I wasn't going to live to see 30. And so there was ways in which I was like, you bought the lie. I was telling myself these things, but even the paradox of it is that those things were true, because I was losing, I lost so many loved ones to AIDS. The thing that made me angriest, I think, was that I was on the first trials for AZT, the first medication, and I was on the trials for the D drugs, which were short-lived but effective. But they started causing neuropathy, and neuropathy is a kind of a numbness and a pain in my feet and hands, especially my feet. But I wasn't as physically able. I mean, I always sort of say 60 is the new 80 when you had HIV for 38 years. You know, we're aging faster. So there was the loss, the sense of loss of self. I mean, ability to do things I wanted to do. And I used to love to take hikes, but I can't do that anymore. So there were so many things I'd given up. And also larger than that, I wasn't living fully. I thought I was living fully, but I wasn't, because I was living with this time bomb in my head. Like, it will all end. Every time somebody would die, I think, I'm next. And so you live that way for a while and you learn to live in the short term. So for me, the anger, I think, came from watching people taking aging for granted. Because, I mean, I know that aging is a privilege, and I know that so many of my friends and loved ones didn't have that privilege. I also know that aging, as Betty Davis says, is not for sissies. She was wrong, because I was a sissy, and and I'm doing it okay. But I mean, some days I just have to stay in bed all day. I also have lucky, because I have been able to form a community around the idea of long-term survivorship and finding other people, because I thought I thought the stuff that I was going through when I was talking about AIDS survivor syndrome, that was only me. I thought I was the only one going through that stuff. And once I started explaining it to other people, other survivors, people that I had lost touch with and started getting back in touch with, it was the same process I did when I was going to die. When I began to realize I was going to live, psychology had always been a kind of hobby of mine, books and reading. I'm a reader. And so I began looking into this idea of what's going on. You know, why am I having all these things? And I was seeing therapists who were very qualified people who were treating me for depression and anxiety and sleep disorder, but they didn't see the bigger picture. That it was about this kind of the torrents of surviving AIDS for so long and all those losses and the loss itself, the loss of the body, the loss of sexy, you know, you're like, oh, where's that belly coming from? And I think as a queer person, as a gay man, you know, we put so much stock in the way we look that it took me some time to embrace the gray and accept the fact that I was going to be older. I mean, am I happy with it now because I've got a good life? I don't make any money, but I got a good life otherwise. I have a husband and a dog and friends. And as I say, I'm doing work that means something to me, but I feel very lucky that I have all that and that AIDS taught me to take your situation and turn it into activism and to turn it into purpose. I mean, I always thought that, you know, I used to watch Oprah and she was talking about find your purpose. And I kept looking. I'm like, I'm looking. but it was never showed up. But my purpose found me in a very unexpected, very awful way. I wouldn't recommend it to anybody. But on the other side of it now, it was the most amazing gift ever.
So tell me, how do you kick ass? In other words, how do you and the others who you are working with and in community with, how do you push back against the AIDS survivor syndrome and find that joy in aging and in surviving despite the horror of the losses?
How do we kick ass? We kick ass by coming together and supporting each other and accepting that what we lived through and what we are dealing with now in the post-trauma, post-resilience age of it is a perfectly natural response to an extraordinary event. But, you know, we're dealing with ageism now, something we never expected to deal with. That thing of being so old, you're invisible to the people again. And it's just, it feels like a bitter pill sometimes, but if you make enough noise, they notice you.
Tez Anderson, thank you so much for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you, Melissa. It's lovely to be with you.
Now, before we go, we want to leave you with the words of our own David Gable. He's a gay man living with HIV, and he is a vital member of The Takeaway team and actually of the entire WNYC team. He's a true inspiration to all of us.
It has gotten tremendously easier. The first decade or so was lots of unknowns, lots of medications, lots of changes, lots of running to the doctor. And truthfully, some of that stuff remains. I still go to the doctor a lot. I still take pills. I still have to be sure I have health insurance. But I am grateful that I am here. I am healthy. I have a non-detectable viral load, which means I can't pass it on to anyone. All of that's terrific. It still is something that people are surprised to hear. It certainly hasn't gone away, but there are a whole bunch of us who lived through it and are here to tell the tale.
And you're a part of this conversation too.
Hey, I'm calling about the question about living with HIV. My name is Daryl. I'm in East Texas, and I'm okay. I'm very grateful for how far science and medicine has come in the ability to live a manageable disease with a manageable illness today. And I don't know what you're asking, but it is possible to live a full life, and I'm so grateful for that.
This is Derek from Vegas, and I'm thriving with HIV.
I don't let HIV get me down.
It has opened me up to a whole new community of people who are dealing with the same issue. And it's sort of been life-saving that I have found a community of folks. So HIV ain't getting me.
Now, if you have anything you want to share with us or you have show ideas, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. We always love hearing from you. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. This is The Takeaway. Come on back for more tomorrow.